Welcome to Into Africa. My name is Judd Devermont. I am the director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I was the National Intelligence Officer for Africa and worked at the National Security Council. This is a podcast where we talk politics and challenge paradigms.
On deck today, ANC Secretary General Ace Magashule could step down over corruption charges. What would his departure mean for South African politics? And African countries are scrambling for access to the COVID-19 vaccine. Will China step in? Plus, we discuss Chinese technology in Africa. What are the national security implications for Africans, and what should the Biden administration do about it?
So whether you have a history with the continent or you're a newcomer, we want to get you into Africa.
ANC Secretary General Ace Magashule is under pressure to step down over corruption charges. Is this a win for South African President Ramaphosa? Joining me to discuss South Africa and other topics are Jeremy Goldkorn, editor-in-chief of SUP China and the co-host of the Seneca podcast, Bulelane Gile, a researcher of Africa-China relations and a PhD candidate at Harvard University, and Carolyn Bartholomew, chair of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. Okay, in late December, the ANC's Integrity Commission recommended that Magashule be suspended because he faces 21 charges of corruption.
When are you stepping aside as the Secretary General of the ANC after the Integrity Commission recommendation that you must step aside with immediate effect? Have you stepped aside, Mr. Magashule?
No, there is a process by the National Executive Committee of the ANC, which is the second highest decision-making body of the ANC after the National Conference. And I think the Integrity Commission was doing its work. Let's leave it there and leave the matter to the National Executive Committee.
He's accused of looting nearly $13.8 million from government projects when he was the premier of South Africa's Free State Province. Now, this is important for two reasons. One, Ramaphosa has made anti-corruption a centerpiece of his administration. And two, it could really affect the balance of power within the ruling party. So, Bulelane, let's start with the first section. Why has this been a key priority for the Ramaphosa government? And, you know, maybe a scorecard, how has he done so far? If Magashule is removed, what does that mean for transparency and accountability?
Yeah, sure. Firstly, I want to thank you for your time and consideration for having me here. I do think this is quite significant for the Ramaphosa administration. And I'd probably underscore three points, and you've already kind of touched on some of them. The first aspect is that Ace Magashule, in fact, is a rival of Ramaphosa and is a supporter, particularly of the previous administration, the Zuma administration, that was inundated with numerous accounts of corruption. And then the kind of second point is that he is currently now outside Zuma, the highest ranked ANC member to have been facing these kinds of charges. And then the third final point is that it's really a test on the impact and the efficacy of the stand-aside policy that was initiated by the ANC effectively to try and curb crime and corruption within the ANC in itself, but also more than anything to attempt to restore accountability and public trust with the ANC.
One of the things that maybe we can expand on a little bit is that, you know, at least before COVID, what President Ramaphosa really was trying to do was to encourage foreign investment in South Africa. And the legacy of the Zuma administration, some of the terrible deals that they were, you know, entertaining with Russia, etc., I think had been a problem for foreign investors. He would be as the Secretary General number four. That would be a shot in the arm, potentially, for what he's trying to achieve when it comes to South Africa's international reputation.
I completely concur on that position. And, you know, the way in which Ace Magashule has been attempting to resist some of the criticism that have been launched against him is on really kind of spurious grounds. You know, effectively, you know, Ace Magashule, when he was asked to step aside and not necessarily step down, he said that, you know, it's within his own constitutional rights as a South African citizen to remain on a position and to be considered innocent until proven guilty. Of course, this is somewhat of an obfuscating frame because the point of the Integrity Commission was for willing individuals to go before it and then to accept some of the recommendations that have been made. And so you rightly point out the fact that at the very least, it's an impediment to some of the reform efforts within the ANC, but also within South Africa. But on a more positive aspect, you know, the Ramaphosa administration generally has been doing relatively well, because the step aside policy, when you're looking at it, it has had impact in South Africa, particularly at the local level and at the provincial levels, where certain ANC members have in fact stepped aside as investigations have been continuing, or they've completely stepped down and lost their positions within the ANC. And so in that sense, the policy position that's been taken has had effect. But, you know, I think for a lot of us, the real test is to see whether or not that, you know, everybody under the law is held accountable in South Africa, particularly at the very top of the ANC.
Yeah, so this is the interesting part, too, is that if he does step aside or step down, it dramatically changes the leadership structure of the ANC. And when Ramaphosa took power, at least of the party in 2017, and then when he took the presidency in 2018, he didn't really have full control of the party. And in fact, when they talk about the top six in South Africa, which as we've just affirmed that Magashule is his number four, most people think that Ramaphosa only has three of them as really his allies, and the other three are connected to former President Zuma. So if he departs, right, big win potentially for Ramaphosa. I mean, what are the political ramifications? Jeremy, do you have thoughts?
I mean, I would just observe that since the 1990s, Ramaphosa has had one of the best reputations for the business community outside of China. And, you know, in reference to what we were discussing earlier, the more secure his power is, I believe the more likelihood South Africa stands of repainting its image amongst the international investor community.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Can I further tag on to this point?
Please.
I personally believe it's really quite unlikely that Ace Magashule will be able to find enough allies within the ANC in order to really depose Ramaphosa, primarily because we know for the last 10 years that the ANC was in decline in terms of support. And it's only, you know, gone up after Ramaphosa has entered office. And so there are many kind of ANC, you know, local members who, you know, thank themselves and thank Ramaphosa for giving them a job. And then two, you know, Ramaphosa himself has done relatively well in terms of governing. And so if Ace Magashule would be able to kind of build a body of allies against him, they would really be looking kind of thinly. The real matter is whether or not, you know, ANC members are, in fact, you know, committing graft rather than, you know, picking straws between the different kinds of camps. Ace Magashule is trying to make it seem like it's a political hit job rather than, in fact, you know, the fact that there is a current illegal investigation against him.
Yeah, well, we're recording this episode in early January, and I suspect by the time this is shared and released, this will still be a live issue. So we'll have to come back and check out what's going on within the fight within the ANC and then the broader anti-corruption campaign. So with vaccine rollouts underway, there are some real concerns that African countries are going to be left behind.
We simply cannot accept a world in which the poor and marginalized are trampled by the rich and powerful in the stampede for vaccines. This is a global crisis, and the solutions must be shared equitably as global public goods, not as private commodities that widen inequalities and become yet another reason some people are left behind.
Bloomberg reported in early January that Moderna had no supplies for Africa, while AstraZeneca had no shots for the continent in 2021. Pfizer has said that they will offer COVID-19 vaccines at a discounted rate of $10 a dose to South Africa, but many South African health officials believe that still will be prohibitively expensive for their nation. And so the frustration is really mounting from African leaders and the public. And this is where I think it gets interesting when it comes to the topics that we focus on a lot on Into Africa, which is the geopolitical competition, diplomatic engagement, because Africans are talking about their preference for vaccines through the WHO's COVAX facility. But they have talked about being willing to accept China's vaccine, even Russia's Sputnik V. And I thought maybe, Jeremy, you could come and explain to us how China is positioning itself in this debate. What are the advantages and disadvantages for African countries when they weigh what China's offering for some of these companies for the COVAX facility, or at least independently on their own?
Well, obviously, China began the year looking very bad as the source of the coronavirus, and with a lot of news coverage of early cover-ups in its attempt to, you know, handle it without letting anyone know. But they very quickly pivoted to seeing COVID-19 as an opportunity to build China's brand, to build China's soft power globally through the provision of PPE. And now we are onto the stage with vaccines. The big problem that China and Russia have had, you know, some people have noted that in all the discussion of vaccines, people were talking about Pfizer being number one, the first vaccine, etc. And some commenters have said, well, what about China and Russia? And one of the big problems with China is, of course, that they're not transparent. So we still don't know exactly how any of the Chinese vaccines have been tested and what the results are. There are at least five, probably six, possibly more under development in China. The one that is closest to readiness and is in fact already being rolled out is the Sinovac, which has been widely distributed in Brazil and is now claiming more than 70% efficacy. So I think that the reputation of these vaccines may be weaker than the offerings from Pfizer and Moderna, partly because of the lack of transparency of the Chinese government. On the other hand, where is Europe, where is the United States in terms of providing any kind of global good, and particularly to Africa? We have some mealy-mouthed promises, and that's about it. And just like we see with infrastructure and technology, Africa needs what China can provide. And if it's going to be a 75% vaccine where we don't have all the clinical data in the same way that Pfizer's presented it, but it's an effective vaccine, why would African countries not take China's offer?
Yeah, I see this trade-off that many of the African countries are debating publicly, right, between accessibility, cost, but then as you point out, Jeremy, in terms of transparency and efficiency, and I think a couple of governments are going to make some pretty hard calls because they need the vaccine. And if they can get the cost and accessibility right, then they may take a risk on this other issue. Carolyn, let me ask you the same question. How have you thought and the commission thought about China's role in this vaccine diplomacy distribution, and what should the U.S. and the international community be doing?
I share a lot of the concerns, right? We want people to be able to have access to the vaccines. I think Beijing could make the decision a whole lot easier if they were transparent and released publicly the data about the tests of these vaccines, because there are concerns among scientists and others about the safety and efficacy. And it's a pretty difficult thing if we learn about safety and efficacy because millions of people have been vaccinated and there are bad consequences. Will agree with Jeremy too that you know, the vaccine diplomacy is a continuation of the mask diplomacy, where Beijing is wanting to frame itself as the solution to rather than the cause of the pandemic. And then we'll raise the concern about sort of the diplomatic implications of this, as well as the public health implications of it, right? First, is this going to be sale or donation of these vaccines, and how are they going to be financed in the African countries? But also, how is Beijing planning to use the vaccine to enlist support for its broader foreign policy goals, right? Such as China's claims in the South China Sea, votes in the UN. In terms of what the US can do, I think that there are a number of things. First, and I know that the Biden administration has said this, which is rejoining the World Health Organization. I think that's an important step. You mentioned COVAX. I think that it's really important for the US to participate in the COVAX initiative, as well as engaging and joining the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation. So I think that those are both symbolic steps, but they are substantive steps too. You know, I would commend Canada for what it's doing with using its access and providing it to other countries that are in need. The reality is it's not going to be safe for all of us until it's safe for everybody in the world. And I think that that's going to be an important guiding principle.
No, absolutely. I think what the Biden administration is talking about is critical, is particularly joining the WHO. And one of the things that I've heard many of the Biden big thinkers on China have said is that we do have to work with China on some issues when it comes to climate change and global health. And I'm wondering, Jeremy, could the Biden administration press China to be more transparent? Is there more room for more of a public release of some of this information and testing? Or is there a point where China is just going to say, no, that's where we have our own way of doing things and we're not going to share this information out?
You know, given the fact that China is currently basically refusing to allow World Health Organization investigators into China to look at the origins of the virus, I do not hold out much hope of any transparency on the part of the Chinese authorities. I think the Biden administration should indeed press them on that, as should all countries that are recipients of, any donations or aid connected to the vaccines. But I don't see that Beijing is going to change its ways. The vaccine is seen as one way of realizing Xi Jinping's China dream of rejuvenating the Chinese nation. And no pesky trial results are going to get in the way of that dream.
It's a critical warning because, I think that we should be pressing China to be as responsible as possible and to be as transparent as possible. And there could be some benefits of that. But we also, I think what you're suggesting, Jeremy, is that there is a limit. There is a place where that stops, where we probably can't break through a wall. And then the effort of the international community, and particularly our African partners, is to constrain or challenge or counter, because at the end of the day, we can't stand by for vaccines being distributed that may not have all of the safety regulations. So it's going to be a balancing act in this specific issue, but in the broader U.S.-China-Africa relationship, which is a perfect segue to our next topic, which is Chinese tech in Africa. Couldn't be any hotter of a topic in this conversation, at least in Washington, where Carolyn and I are. There are real concerns, which I share, about counterintelligence threats that are posed by Huawei and ZTE. But there's the reality that there aren't as many alternatives out there just yet. So, Carolyn, I'd love it if you could start us off here about the commission's perspective on Chinese involvement in Africa's tech sector. What are the risks? Are there any benefits?
Certainly, Judd. Thank you. Of course, there are benefits for people in Africa who are yearning for connectivity and all of the benefits that that brings. Efficiency in markets, access to information. I think that that's an important point to remember is, there's a huge young population across the continent of Africa. People are engaged, they're connected, and the opportunities and the benefits that that all brings. The concern, of course, about it being sort of cornered by Chinese technology is threefold. First is, and I know that you all have talked about this, but the export of techno-authoritarianism to the continent and the misuse, the use of this technology to sort of track dissidents or opponents of the government and to control what people are saying and what they're doing. Beijing is marketing the concept of internet sovereignty, in which each country has the right to control its domestic internet space. I think that there are a number of countries that are finding that an attractive model. And I think it's a downside, of course, for promoting democratic freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to criticize the government. So there's the concern about autocratic regimes using the technology to suppress their opposition figures. And Uganda is a perfect current example of that. It's also concern, of course, about the sale of advanced surveillance technologies and how they're being used. In addition to the technologies, I would say that there's growing concern about data, right? It's not just the equipment itself, but the data that goes across that equipment and how you secure that data and make sure that it's being used in appropriate ways and not inappropriate ways. I think also, and we focus some on this, is that the lost opportunities for American businesses as the digital ecosystem is built around Chinese standards. That has longer term consequences for entrepreneurship in the United States. Our companies rely on the progress that they make in the digital world to fund their R&D for other innovations. And as they are getting shut out of the market, I think it's going to have adverse consequences on the U.S.'s ability to innovate. I'd add one more thing there, which is on telecommunications. You know, the Chinese government has a program to train African journalists, giving them access to training that they might not be getting other places. But it's also using the technology, it's using the outlets to push out a Chinese worldview to the African market. They're providing a lot of free content to people, and that's what people are hearing. So I think it's really important for the United States to re-engage with countries in Africa, to show up and to work with our allies outside of Africa to make sure that people in Africa have access to the kind of technology that would allow them to move forward and also to address these concerns about authoritarianism.
That's such a clear way to present the challenges and the threats. I really like that. And your prescriptions, let's build on that at the end too, because I think that's so important, is not just to admire the problem, to figure out, you know, how we play in this space constructively, understanding the way Africans think about some of this technology, which is not as negative as maybe you and I do. But Jeremy, you've looked at this issue a lot. I've been reading your blog posts, on your podcast. Can you talk a little bit about Huawei, Chinese tech? Do you agree with Carolyn? What has been the African response when U.S. officials or commentators like myself have talked about the downsides? And what's the reaction?
It's a little bit like the PPE and the vaccines. You know, where is the United States? And this is not just a problem of government. You know, obviously, the Chinese government has an awful lot invested in developing partnerships with Africa, developing Africa as a place where it has a lot of political allies, developing the market. But private Chinese companies and entrepreneurs are having a similarly enthusiastic attitude towards the African market. Whereas, you know, if you think about the big American players, and they are pretty much all American, let's face it, you know, Google, Facebook, they have essentially token presences in Africa. They're not really making a very serious effort to develop the market. Whereas in Africa, you have companies like Huawei, which obviously has a lot of state backing. You know, we're not sure how much of its efforts in Africa are in order to provide the Communist Party with listening posts throughout the continent, and how much of them are, you know, just a regular business and making money. But what we can be pretty sure is that, for example, Boomplay, which is now the largest music streaming service in Africa, is backed by Chinese tech companies like NetEase. These companies, they're there for the money. These are companies seeing Africa as a market. Google, Facebook, you know, Twitter, Zoom, you name an important American tech company. What are they doing in Africa? Very little. They have a token presence in Cape Town, maybe in Nairobi, a couple of them in Nigeria, you know, dotted around the continent, and that's it. And unless U.S. companies, as well as the U.S. government, start taking Africa more seriously as a market, why would African countries not be happy to have better mobile phone services, more entertainment, even if it's owned by Chinese?
Yeah, what you're doing is so important, because first of all, we can't look at what China's doing monolithically, and we got to parse out different companies and different sectors. But also, you know, I agree with you, we need to impress our companies and ask them why there has been so little engagement on the continent, and what we can do to assist them, because it's in everybody's interest, particularly for the Africans, to have a competitive market. Data is very expensive in Africa. It's actually one of the most expensive places in the world. And that, I think, is a signal that there's just not a lot of market competition in this space right now. But I want to bring Lelane back in the conversation, because he's done some really interesting work on this topic. I chaired a panel back in the summer, and Lelane had this masterful case study on Ethiopia and how it uses very diverse technology, patches them together. And, you know, you talk in your paper about this sort of hybrid model of surveillance technology. And I'd love you just to explain to the audience what you found, and then maybe push you a little bit to talk about, Is this one way that Africans can manage some of these concerns, counter? I mean, what's the sort of ultimate benefit of this patchwork approach to the various foreign national provided technology?
Yeah, so I guess for your audience, I'll first contextualize my research and then, you know, kind of speak specifically about the Ethiopia case. So, you know, my personal research is very much interested in the spread of Chinese surveillance devices across the African continent, and particularly looking at the adaption and adoption of these technologies by local African actors. And so one of the key tenets of the work is to somewhat challenge the assumption that, you know, China is simply promoting some of these technologies and African actors are just simply acquiescing to the terms that are made available by the Chinese. And so the research, in some sense, is attempting to illustrate China as a compromising actor that is conceding to local condition and local asks. And so this in some way illustrates African agency, but it also illustrates somewhat the absence of a broader strategy by China when interacting with African actors. And what the case of Ethiopia is illustrative of is that, you know, the Ethiopians have been able to establish an ICT infrastructure that was, you know, financed and built by the Chinese, but they've also bought commercially available spyware from, you know, UK-based companies, German-based companies, and Italian-based companies, which have put together effectively a hybridized surveillance capacity that in some ways, you know, is a threat to some of the civil liberties of, you know, citizens. And in some instances, the ICT infrastructure that has been built by the Chinese is also illustrative of some of the developmental aspects and goals of the Ethiopian government. And so to me, you know, what is the real threat is really the absence of some of the legal architecture that is necessary in order to preserve civil liberties as we're dealing with this technical inflection point.
So the legal architecture, absolutely, I agree with you. And I think we could be talking about a more effective architecture around all of the topics we've talked about today, whether it's investment, whether it is vaccine diplomacy, and certainly on tech. But you may not know the answer to this, but does the hybrid model perhaps help prevent Chinese backdoors?
Yeah, well, so we don't particularly know from observational and kind of, you know, field work data exactly some of how the backdoors of these Chinese systems are working. But what is quite interesting and distinct is that, well, distinct in the sense that there are, you know, ways in which African governments have been buying commercially available spyware in order to meet some of their intelligence wants. And all of these commercially available spyware is coming from NSO groups, for instance. But the infrastructure itself is coming, you know, from China. And so, you know, that in itself, you know, doesn't necessarily get to the question of whether there are back doors, but it is illustrative of the fact that African governments across the continent are appealing to, you know, commercially available channels to meet their surveillance wants.
I think it's a really interesting topic to continue to explore. And I'll just point out, Ulelane has written for the African Center for Strategic Studies on some of this stuff too. So you'll keep an eye out for his work and we'll attach some of it to the show notes. But I want to end just on maybe a little of a look ahead. As I said, this episode comes out right after the inauguration. And so I'm just would like to go through our guests and get some thoughts on whether it's building out more recommendations on how to manage Chinese engagements and interactions in Africa, or maybe a warning to the Biden team about thinking about, you know, blind spots on this issue, or just predictions on where we're going to go. And why don't we change the order up a little bit, and we'll go Jeremy and then Ulelane, and then we'll end with Carolyn.
The first thing I would say is the U.S. has to show up. You know, Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, just got back from his annual tour of Africa. So the foreign minister, this was the 30th year, consecutive year, that the Chinese foreign minister made his first overseas trip to Africa. And, you know, this is just a symbol of China's ongoing engagement. And of course, under the Trump administration, everything has gone haywire in terms of foreign relations. But even before Trump, at best, you could characterize America's attitude to Africa as, you know, neglect. So there's absolutely no chance of the United States removing China's influence or moderating China's influence in Africa. When it comes to China more broadly, you know, this is going to be one of the toughest and, you know, could be a defining challenge for the Biden administration. And it's a very complicated mess that he has to step into. The political appetite in the United States, I mean, the only thing that there is true bipartisan consensus on at the moment in Washington, D.C., is that we got to get tough on China. That's it. That's pretty much the only thing the American political classes agree on. And you see the same message in much of the media. And this, to a certain extent, boxes in the Biden administration. It makes certain choices more difficult. What I would hope is to see, you know, less noise and more substance. Much of the hostile tone towards China has simply been that. You know, a typical example of this is the ongoing ban or not ban of TikTok. The tough rhetoric puts Beijing in a difficult place, makes it very difficult to negotiate anything with China, and then it's not followed through with any kind of real action. So I guess my advice would be talk less, do more.
I can get behind talk less, do more. I can also get behind showing up. Bulelane, what do you think?
I think very much in a similar vein, you know, the African Continental Free Trade Area is now running, and it could be a game changer, specifically if the enabling environment is created for it. And so catering to the interests of infrastructure is quite key. Obviously, with the current pandemic, the BRI, so the Belt and Road Initiative, will not be as effective in supporting and creating the kind of infrastructural network that Africa needs. And so in a lot of ways, vaccine diplomacy becomes another key marker of Chinese branding in a moment in which they can't provide the necessary finance to continue with these projects. And so more than anything, this has created an environment and an opportunity for the United States to re-enter and support African efforts in building a trade environment. I think, you know, that's where, you know, they could most easily and quickly support African efforts.
I like that. It's my sense, by the way, that I think the Biden administration will more embrace the CFTA than the Trump administration. So I think that's a good starting point. We may have to have another episode about how the BRI does or does not affect the Continental Free Trade Agreement. That's a really interesting point. Carolyn, why don't you end us? Why don't you give us your parting shots?
Lots and lots of challenges for a new Biden administration. I would add to the list of showing up and engaging, educating right here in the United States, because I think that there are a lot of companies and a lot of people who still have a very old vision of Africa and not recognizing the vibrancy. And, you know, as I said, the potential with such a young, growing population. And I think it's very important to focus on that so that American companies understand the benefits that they would get by engaging and, you know, participating and selling and all of that in Africa. On a bigger picture, while I have disagreed with the Trump administration on many of the tactics and the tools that it has used, I think that it has actually, one of the only things I'll give them credit for is raising the visibility of the concerns about China's rise in the world and the problems in the U.S.-China relationship. And I hope that the Biden administration doesn't walk away from the recognition that these issues are there. I also hope that they are able to pull together what I would sort of call a multi-issue approach. Through the 1990s, we ended up having a situation where people would say, well, we couldn't express concern about issue X, say, for example, human rights in China, because we needed their cooperation on issue Y. In that case, it was North Korea. And look what we got for that, which is not a whole lot. So I really hope that they are able to put together a sophisticated approach generally on U.S.-China issues where they recognize that there are going to be places that we cooperate and need to cooperate with China, but that those places should not sacrifice all of the issues where we have concerns. I think it's really important also for them to recognize that, you know, this idea of the Chinese model of the community of common human destiny, that a lot of the continent of Africa is being used as sort of a template or a test run for that. And the consequences of that other places in the world, I think, really need to be recognized. So we have very specific issues and challenges we need to address with China's growth in Africa, but we also really need to recognize recognize that what they are learning from their lessons there, they're going to be using other places, including Latin America and the Caribbean. So a lot of challenges for a new Biden administration. I am hopeful with their experience and their expertise that they will be able to move us forward, both in relationships on the continent of Africa and elsewhere in the world.
Thanks. This is bad for podcasts, but I'm vigorously nodding. You're not going to be able to see that, but I think I think those are really important points. So let me thank the three of you for joining us today. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. We want to have more conversations about Africa. Tell your friends, subscribe to our podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you find good content. You can also check out our analysis and reports at csis.org/Africa. Thanks.